Now on Bloomberg 106.1.
I would love to tell you that the banking industry doesn't need any regulations. We can just trust them to operate responsibly on their own, but clearly that's not the case.
The bank failures were really idiosyncratic in nature. In terms of whether there's more coming, I think it's unlikely.
We think the capital gains decreases will help make it more affordable to be an investor in a business in Massachusetts.
This is Bloomberg Bay State Business
with Tom Maroney, Joe Shortsleeve, and Kim Kerrigan
on Bloomberg 106.1 Boston Newburyport and 92.9 HD2.
All righty, and just like that, it's June, Thursday, June the 1st. Well, I guess they call this the first day of what, meteorological summer. We're here for the next 3 hours until 6 o'clock tonight. We've got, on this June 1st, we've got, 87 degrees in downtown Boston. How about that? Equity markets, they are in the green as we come on the air. The Dow's up 0.6% or some 200 points. NASDAQ's up just about 1.5% or 185 points. Joe Shortsley, Tom Maroney, Kim Kerrigan's back on the news desk. Ann Mastu's right here in the studio. Janet Wu will be long as well. In this hour, Ann Mastu has been listening in as the new general manager of the MBTA. Phil Ang answers questions about the future of the MBTA, and he's been answering them from the T's advisory board, the executive director, Brian Kane, who's a frequent visitor to this program. Then at 3:30, we're going to be joined by State Senator Julian Sear from Cape Cod, talk about legislation he's pushing that would restore happy hours.
Restore the happy hour? I got one going here right now. What's this restore talk?
Yeah,
I'm going right now. Hey, listen, on this date in 2004, June 1, I officially became a full-time employee at Bloomberg.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Eight million years ago?
What year did you say?
2004.
Oh. Look at you. Congratulations. That's great.
A long time.
19. Okay.
I'm waiting for the gifts to arrive. Not from you folks, but, you know, elsewhere. on our 5 o'clock hour, 5 o'clock tonight, our guest is at 5:31 is Andrew Casey, president of Biotech Canada, which is the Canadian equivalent to our Mass Bio here in the Commonwealth. Ann's been doing a lot on this. She's going to be actually participating in this big conference Monday. We'll talk about that with her, of course. But Casey will talk about business opportunities for companies here and update us on the building of Moderna's manufacturing facility in his country and all sorts of things about new and innovative products coming from our neighbors in the north. And Kim Kerrigan, welcome back. What's
Thank
on your
you so
mind?
Much. Sure. Well, actually, this is a story that Joe pointed out to me, but it's such a great talker. People have been noticing that some of the lights along I-93 and in Boston, some of the street lights are purple.
Yeah.
And so they started reporting these purple lights. And as it turns out, this is called the Great Purpling. It actually has a name.
Really?
And it's when LED lights have a defect, they turn purple. And LED lights, of course, are being put in all over the highways and in the city for, you know, efficiency. And MassDOT says they're not a problem, and they are trying to replace them, but it takes a while to get the parts, I guess, when they begin to purple.
How is it we ended up with defective lights? I guess that might be a question someone might
ask. That would be the next question you may want to ask, right?
We want to talk to Ann Mastu, who's here in the 106.1 studio, because today the general manager of the T, Phil Ang, was peppered with questions in a virtual forum about the future of his agency. This was hosted by the MBTA Advisory Board. They represent cities and towns that help fund the T service. And as I said, Ann has those details. Ann.
Yes, Tom, Joe, and Kim. The MBTA Advisory Board, I'll just remind you, is composed of a chief elected official from each of the 176 cities and towns along public transit. And the board plays a key role in the allocation of federal funds for MBTA capital-related projects. Brian Kane, executive director of the MBTA Advisory Board, served as moderator.
So you've been here about a month and a half. What is different than what you thought it would be? What similarities are you seeing with Long Island Railroad and with the MTA? And maybe what's the biggest surprise that you've noticed since you've arrived?
I don't know if I would say things are different, right? When I was at New York City Transit and when I was at Long Island Railroad, in both cases, service and reliability of service was at some of its low points in its history. Public confidence had waned. And the challenge was, how do you accomplish this tremendous amount of effort to restore state of good repair, or at least start moving in the direction of a state of good repair? What I have seen here is a tremendous amount of dedicated employees. But what I think I am looking to do with them is to make sure that they realize they're in these roles for a reason, and they're challenging roles, but they should be empowered to make those decisions. And I think what I've seen is that often the decisions are more to a larger group versus empowering one entity. And what I've told them is, if it's a decision that you are not comfortable, then certainly bring it to my attention and I will help make a decision if we need to, right? Because we're always balancing priorities. And I know in my first introduction, what is the number one priority? But I also know in the roles we play, everything is a priority. Safety has to always be, customer service always has to be. But then how do you accomplish this work quickly and at the same time make sure it's safe?
Eng says he's brought in potential hires for introductions before he's offered them a job to see whether there's a potentially good team. And he pointed out that lately his and the public's focus has largely been on the state of the subway. But he says he's also focused on the commuter rail, buses, even water transit. Also questioned today was Thomas Glynn, now chair of the MBTA Board of Directors, but he served as general manager of the T under former Governor Michael Dukakis. Here's Kane questioning Glynn.
Nowadays, we'd be over the moon if we had a 50% approval rating. But how do we get back there, given the financial challenges?
You know, Phil has kind of started a process of trying to reach out to various people in the business community to kind of get their sense of, you know, what might be possible. We have 2 years before we hit the fiscal cliff, as the Mass Taxpayers Foundation has defined it. So that gives us some time to try to put together some options and, you know, work with the communities that you folks represent. So I don't think there's any easy solution. I've been in touch with Rich Davey, because New York just went through a similar exercise, and he sent me some material of kind of some of the creative ideas that they pursue. So, you know, we're just trying to build an inventory at the moment.
After the one-hour forum ended, I immediately got on the phone with Kane to get his reaction.
I think we heard a consistent message from both the GM and the board chair about a need or a desire to be more transparent, more open. And also, the two things that I heard that were new were a sense to empower team employees and a desirability to get more involved earlier in sort of major projects and planning processes. And that's huge. That's something that many of us have been looking for years. And to hear it said is great.
Okay, so you left the meeting with a sense of optimism, it sounds like?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the governor made two great appointments with Glynn and Eng, and I feel even more so now.
I think that what was interesting to me was all the talk about Dukakis and the way things were. And
sure.
I mean, I guess that's important to point out, and that the level of investment and interest from a governor is very important. But it just, at moments, I was thinking that it sounded like there was just a lot of the good old days conversation and not a level of urgency about what's going on now.
I think what you're hearing, Ann, is this kind of real mundane stuff that every business needs to have. You need to have this kind of back office stuff that just works and is unsexy and kind of dull. But that's what is the backbone of everything. And I think what you're hearing from the GM and from the board chair is a desirability to get boring again. My God, can you imagine a day where we didn't have to think about the team not working, that it was just boringly running in the background?
I wanted to ask a little bit about movement among cities and towns that have commuter rail stations or have MBTA stations, and the push that I know Governor Baker had started to build affordable housing along those lines within walking distance of the stations. What's the latest you're hearing in terms of cities and towns actually moving forward with that?
Well, it's really been mixed. I mean, across the 176 communities that this applies to, some like Lexington are all in and are gung-ho. And others, a few South Shore towns that just said, no, we're not going to do it. I think it's mixed. I think folks want more information. And I think a lot of it also has to do with the T. You know, as I said today, the MBTA community's zoning reform is predicated on having a transportation system that's safe, frequent, reliable, fast, and relatively inexpensive. And that's not what's being delivered right now in lots of places. And sort of until there's more confidence in that, I think you're going to still see municipalities be reticent to permit more housing. I think you're going to see a development community that's very concerned that they're just going to be building homes for people to get stuck in traffic in. As they said today, it's all connected. And I think what you heard today is a desire, at least from the GM, to start making those linkages once again, which is great. You know, the new housing secretary got sworn in today, so wouldn't it be great if we could start working with them?
Again, that's Brian Kane, executive director of the MBTA Advisory Board, and he's referring just there to the new housing secretary, Edward Augustus, former Worcester city manager, who's coming to office today.
Well, very good, Andy. Now, Kane has been on this program a number of times, and he has expressed the same sort of optimism toward this group. He thinks that Eng and he thinks that Glenn are old, are experienced.
Right,
and
they sure are.
That's not something he's seen in a while, which is kind of interesting. I mean, I think we asked, or Joe and I asked the question at one point, these guys showed up now. Why haven't people like them showed up before? But again, it's good to hear Brian is sounding a positive note here.
Yeah, because he's pretty candid with us on the air. And in the past, he has not felt optimistic.
That's right.
You know, I mean, as a group of reporters in this room who have watched the MBTA for all the years that we have watched them, I think one thing that you always kind of felt is that you weren't going to get a response. You were going to get put off or pushed out or get some sort of glossy response. And a forum like today, maybe it's a simple thing, but maybe it's the first step in, you know, the transparency they're talking about that will, you know, restore trust.
I find the advisory board much more willing to talk to the press than anyone on the MBTA board of directors or the MBTA organization itself. And, I mean, Eng was very diplomatic, talking about the importance of committing to safety and innovation, the sort of things we've all heard for years and years. And I can't say that I left listening that meeting feeling very optimistic, but as a tea writer and user myself. But I'm glad to know the advisory board, who's paying closer attention, is feeling that way.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think Brian has said that they didn't talk to him before.
He said,
in fact, we use it in one of our introductions. It said, you know, they don't talk to me because I talk to people like you and you. I also say this, and I'm sure you've made note of it. A longtime spokesman, Joe Pesatoro, is gone.
And kidding. Is he really?
Yeah. And
I
in
didn't
his
know
place,
that.
It was a quiet departure, too. Right. For somebody who had been there almost 40 years, it was a quiet
that's
departure.
That's fascinating. Yeah, because he was the only person who talked to the press.
Well,
and they were very careful.
And they replaced him with a Marty Walsh, a former Marty Walsh hand, Gabrielle Farrell.
Right, who was with the Boston Public Schools, and now she's a spokesman.
She went to Marty,
I didn't realize that
to Elizabeth
Joe left.
Warren.
That's interesting.
So she's there. Yeah, so that, I don't know what that means, but it's going to mean something.
Okay, now, do you guys know what that is?
I'm my foot is tapping.
No.
A drum roll.
Long. That is the Boston Typewriter Orchestra.
Oh, come on.
Listen to it. These are typewriters.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like
that you have the little bell there, of course.
You're like an old-fashioned big old typewriter. Anyway, this is a group that was put together back in 2004. And it's kind of funny. This guy, Tim Devine, he was in a bar and he had his typewriter. I have no idea why. And the waitress asked him to stop typing on the typewriter. And he said that he was the conductor of a non-existent orchestra and that he would not put it away.
Have another drink.
Well, the results of that now, there are six members of this group, one of them just recently joining who is a woman, and they make appearances all over the state all the time. Their next appearance is going to be at the Foundry in West Stockbridge on June the 10th, so you can see them there. And they get together and they practice, and I watched one of their practices. And
I saw the picture on the front page of the Globe.
Yeah.
It's like, wow.
Yeah. But actually, I mean, that's how do you figure that out? I don't know.
It's like, that's it.
Boy, that doesn't, now that part didn't sound to me at all like a typewriter.
Yeah, no.
That sounds like a drum, like I said.
I mean, think about how hard that is to make that quickly.
Yeah.
They go through some typewriters out there.
Oh, they must.
All right.
There
well,
you
very
it.
Good, Kim. Yeah. Always interesting.
The Boston Typewriter Orchestra.
Yeah. Well, let's move on here, switch gears a bit, and talk about, you know, happy hour, drinks, alcohol. I mean, do I have your attention? Joining us now, Senator Julian Cyr, who is obviously a senator on Cape Cod. He's one of two lawmakers seeking the revival of the happy hour. So, Senator, first, welcome back. It's been a little bit since we've chatted. And I guess I want to start with this. You know, this came up in the Charlie Baker administration, and the governor said, no way, I'm not signing that. Do you have any kind of assurance from the new governor that this will get on her desk and she'll sign it?
So it's good to be with you folks. It has been a little while, but always good to join you. I think momentum's building around revisiting the ban that went into place in 1984, before people like me were born, relative to happy hour. I think a number of conditions have changed. To be clear, this is a local option, a happy hour. So this would allow municipalities to opt in if they'd so choose. I understand why, for certain communities and certain neighborhoods, happy hour doesn't make sense. But for a lot of downtowns and main streets that are really struggling with foot traffic, particularly with so many of us working from home, we need to find ways to get people back on our main streets, back downtown, to support our restaurants, our bars, our other retail stores. And so we think that a local option happy hour could be one tool to help revitalize these main streets and downtowns. I don't know where the governor is on this, but it is a new administration. The Senate actually is already in record in support of this. We adopted local option happy hour in the economic development package we passed last session. So we already got one chamber on record for it, and I think we're trying to do the legwork now to explain why we think it makes sense to revisit this policy.
Talking with State Senator Julian Cyr, he's been in office up there on Beacon Hill since 2017. But I think also I remember from your bio, you grew up in the restaurant business, and you know that the Massachusetts Restaurant Association has come out against this idea. They don't like it.
So I did grow up. My family had a restaurant. I've been in a restaurant for 28 years. I spent more years of my life waiting on tables, serving drinks, working on the line. Look, this isn't happy hour. Isn't something that every restaurant may want to pursue, but the current way that we allow happy hour in Massachusetts is essentially discounting food. When you look at what goes into running a restaurant, your biggest costs are labor. Your second biggest cost is food. The place where you actually have the most profit margin is actually in alcohol and drinks. Right, the markup from 4 to 6%. Four to six times. So that's why I think we think it makes sense. I also, I've spent most of my policy work focused in public health. I chair the public health committee. I take very seriously addiction and particularly issues with alcohol abuse. What's interesting is several states have repealed their happy hour bans in recent years. We're actually the last state left standing. We're the only state in the country with a happy hour ban in effect. But interestingly, in the last decade, both Illinois and Kansas repealed their happy hour ban and did not see any increase in traffic-related fatalities involving alcohol or another adverse effect. So I think some things certainly have changed since 1984. Back then the drinking age was 18, it wasn't 21. We didn't have the stiff penalties in place that we have now when people drive under the influence. I think certainly the advent of ride-sharing services also helped people, get home safely. I think the culture has changed a bit. And again, this isn't a fit for every community, but it's a tool that I think could be helpful. I was hearing from constituents on Martha's Vineyard who were saying, "Yeah, we don't need a happy hour to get people in the doors, July and August, but in the off season, this could help us."
I see. Well, that does answer one of my questions, Senator. And I'm hoping, or maybe you can do this. If there, you must be talking to restaurants, to places on this very issue. Maybe even places, as you said, down on Cape Cod. Can you give us an example with a little more detail of one of these places and why they argue for a happy hour? Because I think Cape Cod, I think up your way, the Beachcomber, they don't need a happy hour during the summer. What happens in the winter when you do have a happy hour? Do they see a significant increase in business?
So the Beachcomber doesn't have heat, so they're probably not going to be in operation in the winter. But I was talking to actually two restaurateurs in Martha's Vineyard who were saying, look, this could be a tool for us to get people in the door, in Oak Bluffs and in Edgartown. I think we've heard from businesses in Boston, in Provincetown, in Pittsfield, who'd be interested in having this. I think the other piece as well, right, is that Massachusetts has got a bit of a fun problem, right? You talk to any, you know, millennial.
A fun problem?
A fun problem, okay. Right? Yeah. You talk to any younger person who's lived in other states, you know, like I have. I lived in New York City, lived in Washington, D.C., and traveled across the country. No, I've yet to encounter a young person in Massachusetts who says this place is terribly fun. And I say really? This in all seriousness, right, where, you know, you look at the cost of housing here, right? For millennials, for Generation Z, it is so hard for us to make it in this state. And I think we really need to, you know, of course be addressing housing. We need 200,000 housing units to be built as soon as possible. We need to address a lot of things. But I also think we need to work on having more attractive downtowns and Main Street, particularly where we have a whole generation of people who are working from home. I think we got to get people out of their houses, back downtown, back to Main Street. Look, happy hour's not a panacea. But it's a tool that could be useful, and so that's why I've brought it forward.
We're talking to State Senator Julian Sear. Let's talk about another topic that you just brought up, and it has to do with lawmakers in Cape Cod and beyond are dealing with this whole housing issue, what to do about the housing situation, especially with the seasonal workers that are in great demand down there in Cape Cod. Up next, we're going to be talking with Andrew Gottlieb. He's an executive director of the Association to Preserve Cape Cod. I'm sure you know him well. He's written about, you know, rethinking the use of Joint Base Cape Cod, the old Otis Air Force Base, and I mean, I'd like to get your idea. I mean, obviously, we could build housing there. I mean, get your idea. Is that a solid way to go? But the issue he raises in his op-ed in Commonwealth Magazine is he talks about how this 50-year lease, he talks about the behind-the-scenes and largely hidden from public view 50-year lease extension to the year 2019 that was pushed through in the closing Baker administration represents a major roadblock. Do you agree with his characterization of that lease that there was, you know, it was basically snuck through in the 11th hour?
So I'm not that familiar with that. You know, look, I think anything we do on Joint Base Cape Cod could be helpful, but I want listeners to be really clear of the crisis we have on Cape Cod and the island. You know, we've seen a 54% increase in housing prices on Cape Cod in the last 5 years. That means that lifelong Cape Codders like me can't afford to purchase a home here. For me to buy a town, I rent, I don't own. For someone like me to purchase a town, purchase a home in the town, my hometown of Truro, a household needs to make $400,000. The Cape Cod Chamber of Commerce did a survey. Nearly 50% of our workforce on Cape Cod is commuting over the bridges each and every day. They live off Cape. So, you know, sure, look, can we build some housing on Joint Base Cape Cod and do some other things? Yeah, but the timeline on that is a little too long for me. We need to see rezoning in our existing downtowns and villages. We need to be building more densely. We need to be putting in place year-round deed restrictions potentially to make sure that, you know, folks who live here year-round have a fighting chance in the housing market. We need a transfer fee on luxury real estate to help pay for all these sort of programs. So, you know, look, Joint Base Cape Cod is a unique asset to the Cape and Islands, and you know, I think certainly can be a factor. But when I look at this crisis now, we need housing built yesterday. And so we can't afford to wait to say, oh, let's put all the housing on, you know, Joint Base Cape Cod. No, we need all of our existing downtown to rezone. So, we need to build more densely. By the way, we need wastewater and sewers, which Andy's been a huge champion of and really helpful. So I just think, yeah, sure, Joint Base Cape Cod is an option, but we also need to be building in our existing downtown.
So, Senator, we're plumb out of time here, but, I mean, as far as housing goes, here we are up against summer. And we've been talking about this on the program, and we know there are some measures, including this idea to give these restaurants incentives to create some kind of stipend or tax break if they provide some housing or housing stipend. I mean, what does the summer look like to you as far as seasonal help? Is there going to be a dire shortage? Are we better than last year? What's your sense of it?
So we've had a shortage of seasonal help here for 20 years, right? And that's why, you know, restaurants like my family, you know, began relying on the H-2B and J-1 visa programs years ago. If you're a major employer, a seasonal employer, you have housing for your employee. What's now happened is that any employer, right, not just restaurants, motels, seasonal employers, but the hospital, human service providers, fire departments and school districts are all looking at where are we going to house our workforce. And so I think the workforce shortage here, it's not just about our seasonal workforce. It's about all of our workforce. And it all really ties to housing. If anything, what was happening for seasonal employers is now, you know, the last two decades is now extended to most every employer in every sector imaginable. This is why we need to, you know, very rapidly build more housing, rezone, you know, put in place the sewer systems we need, right, to build more densely, to have year-round housing, to really have a hope of having a sustainable year-round community out here. So I just, so it's bigger than, you know, the sort of summer workforce shortage. Yeah. But you'll continue to see closed restaurants, you know, on Mondays and Tuesdays, right? Yeah. Because you don't have the help. You can't keep the doors open.
It happens to be the historical battle between flesh and steel, between the brain of man and the product of man's brain.
No 9,000 computer has ever made a mistake or distorted information. We are all foolproof and incapable of error.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
Can a robot write a symphony? Can a robot turn a canvas into a beautiful masterpiece?
Shall we play a game?
Is this a game or is it real?
What's the difference?
The point is that too often man becomes clever instead of becoming wise. He becomes inventive but not thoughtful.
Dumbo what he got to Mr. Roboto.
Okay. Here we go. AI on the front burner here at Bloomberg Bay State Business. We want to invite tech reporter Jackie Davalos into this discussion now. Jackie, you've written several things. I want to start with this AI leader's warning of risk of extinction. This is the destruction of humanity we're talking about, not a small topic. I want to start with a quick summary of what I saw last night on CNN. Neil deGrasse Tyson, the astrophysicist, was on a panel, and I think he makes an excellent point here. He says AI has been killing it for years, that they beat us in chess, Jeopardy. They're doing the calculations that send us to the moon and beyond. But God forbid, when they start writing our term papers, everyone panics. So the point being, this has been with us a long time. Why all the, I don't know, hysteria?
Well, the big difference is that Neil deGrasse Tyson is part of a pretty niche group of scientists that have used this stuff for a while. But as you've seen, ChatGPT was released to the masses just last fall. Before that, it was really only in the hands of a few in AI labs or in industries where it was much more widely used. And the other reason is because the ease with which this can be used, you don't need a computer science degree to put in a prompt, generate some text, some images, pretty, you know, coherent essays, but also what some would even consider works of art, if you can imagine. So the big difference here is that it's in the hands of millions of people, not just a few. It's incredibly potent in how believable, how sophisticated a lot of the output is.
Well, Jackie, why are these brilliant minds warning us of the possibility of the risk of extinction?
Right. We go from generating some avatars to the end of humanity pretty quickly. But the real concern around this has been around the explainability of some of these AI models. Yes, it can do a lot, but there's so much that we don't know. Even scientists themselves acknowledge, look, we feed a lot of this data into these large language models, but there's a lot in the in these algorithms that is difficult to parse out. And that's kind of when you get into the uncertainty of, is there a possibility that we train an AI so well that it can then start to trick humans, that it can turn against us in some way? That would imply that there's some kind of consciousness to these machines. And that issue of sentience, that is this technology self-aware, is something that's been debated for years. The reason it's really starting to intensify now is because the sophisticated nature of this technology is growing. And also, we don't have a test for, you know, how do you know if a machine is conscious all of a sudden? There's nothing to test for that. So therefore, we don't know. And that just generates more fear around what do we do when we actually get there.
Jackie Davalos with us on this important discussion on AI. Now, you've written also about higher ed in the saying it's ill-prepared for the chaos of generative AI. We've had educators on this program, and I have to agree with you on your reporting. I mean, these these folks, I wouldn't say they're stumped, but this is also new. And, you know, when we listen to them talk, Jackie, it's as if they really don't have a grip on this, like grasping smoke. I mean, what are your thoughts?
The educators were really caught off guard, and they're the first to acknowledge that, you know, many have always been somewhat slower to embrace technology as it comes. But this time, you can't just ban it. Everyone has phones and technology in a way that you have to deal with in the moment. And that requires a huge learning curve for them to kind of decide, hey, look, what are we teaching you inside the classroom? Is this really about the soft skills or the hard skills, the social aspect? It's really starting to turn the spotlight on them, not just the students anymore, on what are we paying you guys to do here? And they're the first to kind of start to question, hey, maybe we need to take a much tougher look at the value we're bringing to our students, because what we're doing now isn't working. How do we assess whether a student is a good writer if it's really, you know, ChatGPT that's doing the work in the background?
Yeah, but I mean, we've got to have answers to these questions and have them quickly. I mean, are there any guardrails being put up in this area that would, you know, help calm some nerves?
You know, in the education space, you're seeing some universities start to create rules around, you know, you can't use generative AI in this type of writing exercise or this coding exercise, but how they enforce that is still a huge question, because there's no real way to kind of see if it was plagiarized, because these language models produce such original work still, even though it is rather derivative from the data already out there. On the whole, regulators are grasping this as they go. They had the CEOs of some of these companies on Capitol Hill over the last month, and they're asking questions to companies themselves, looking for guidance on what should we be regulating, which is kind of a strange way to turn it around. But it just goes to show how behind lawmakers are, just the general public as well. And like, where do we even start? Do we start with the application or at the model level, you know, the actual large language model? And so it's a really complex issue that's still being drawn out.
It isn't often that we ask, or I ask, what a reporter is doing and what they're following, but this seems very apropos. I mean, you have another story about more artists embracing AI, and we talked about higher ed, we've talked about this end of humanity. I mean, it must be exciting to be you, but tell us how you decide what to write about. I mean, it's all just seems to be popping at once.
You know, the way I look at it is, what's going to impact our lives on a daily basis? The show that I co-host with my colleague Nate Langson, AI IRL, is just about that. There's a lot swirling around AI, but how are our lives actually being impacted? And those industries that we covered are some of the top ones. The things that, you know, I look at is, we hear a lot about the doom and gloom, but that seems like a much more, and even experts say, look, this is still farther down the line. It's hypothetical at this point. What's happening in the now? And that's where you start to get into the really exciting things like medicine and what AI is doing for the health space to make it easier to develop drugs more accurately, faster, cure, you know, can we finally cure cancer? That's the kind of stuff that excites me.
Yeah, but it's concerning when the CEOs of the companies that actually developed this technology or this artificial intelligence are the one issuing the starkest of warnings.
Totally, and it's unlike anything that we've ever seen in the tech world. You know, Silicon Valley is always the first to be evangelizing the next new technology, but now you have these AI evangelists also being somewhat of the AI doomers at the same time. And so it kind of makes you wonder, what are the motives here? Some of the folks that I talked to would contend on the more skeptical front that those existential risk scenarios are actually distracting from the real life impact that AI is having. On the more negative front, which can mean, you know, algorithmic bias, the ethics of, you know, how some work is recreated and who gets credit for that. That's the stuff that's happening in the now. And by focusing on some of the more, you know, doomsday scenarios, critics would contend is actually distracting from that.
All right. So, Jackie, we need a straight answer here. And this is actually why we brought you on the program. Will AI destroy humanity?
Absolutely not. It's nowhere close to that. But you know,
how can you be so sure?
You know, I can't. But at the point that at this stage, AI is just not that sophisticated, and we're giving it a from my perspective, we're giving it a little too much credit. Does it have immense potential? Certainly, but I think it's going to be a few years before we should start talking about the apocalypse.
Other headlines that we're following closely here in Bloomberg Bay State Business, we continue our look at Flywire. That's the Boston-based fintech that went public exactly 2 years ago. Our Janet Wu joins us now here in our Boston studio, and she sat down with the Flywire CEO for an extensive conversation. Janet.
Yes, yesterday Mike Massaro talked about travel trends, since Flywire specializes in processing payments for travel, health, and higher education. He has a front row seat to what's happening in those areas. The company is also coming off a big quarter, having signed a record number of new clients, and it reported moving a record $5.7 billion around the world through its payment platform, a 35% jump from Q1 last year. Before we talk about the growth of the company in the 2 years since the IPO, I want to pick up on the overall travel trends Mike Massaro and Flywire are seeing.
The consumer, even if they are under pressure due to just macroeconomic conditions, I think they're still going to prioritize experiences, right? And you can see that whether you look at even just restaurants, right? You know, they're back and they're full and they're busy. And the same thing. The case when you hop on an airplane, right? Midweek, you're seeing planes full. I just came back from some investor meetings in New York, and you know, Tuesday, Wednesday used to only be full of business suits prior to the pandemic. Now you have families, now you have individuals traveling for a combination of business and personal experiences at all times. And so I think you're just seeing a shift in people's willingness to travel at all times. Potentially even work from a remote location. And I think that's turning into people prioritizing experiences and things that they, you know, weren't able to really get out and do for the last 2 years.
Do you think that the new hybrid work is a factor in all of this?
Oh, completely. And I think it will be a trend to watch. I mean, our focus on Flywire is how do we provide flexibility, right? We believe that in-person time is massively valuable. And critical to people building relationships, to coming up with creative ideas, to solving problems for customers. But at the same time, you have to realize that the world has, I think, changed. And there's more flexibility in that. You have to provide people the opportunity to work from different places, experience different things. And I think you're going to continue to see that bleed over into travel trends. It's very common for a flymate to be working in many different locations, right? Mm-hmm. Sometimes even overseas and travel the world and continue to work, right? We have a global business of 1,100 people, and you know, it's over 40 nationalities. And so we see it as a strength for our business, and we'll continue to kind of invest in that way.
We are speaking with Mike Massaro, CEO of Boston-based Flywire. Indeed, although you are based in Boston, your business is global. What percentage of your payment processing is to the U.S. as opposed to overseas?
Yeah, more than half of our payment volume is kind of cross-border in nature. So, you know, we have a growing business where we're doing all types of payments, including domestic payments. So, you know, if you look at universities like the University of Virginia or Stanford, Texas A&M, UConn, those are all good examples of universities who are using us to process domestic payments and cross-border payments. But, you know, the first 6-7 years of the company were really focused on cross-border. So still, the vast majority of the payment volume is cross-border in nature, coming into the United States across the industries that we're serving.
I want to ask you about two other trends that we are seeing in travel, and that is the extension of what is defined as a peak season. And you mentioned the very full planes. We are seeing this all the time, everywhere.
Yeah, and we see it as well. You know, I think people have more flexibility than they've ever had before. I also, you know, remember there's just been so much digitization of travel experiences. I mean, you know, so many people can keep scrolling on Instagram and see these amazing pictures of, you know, all these exotic places to go. And so a company's ability to get to the consumer, tell them about their experiences, and for people to find amazing travel opportunities, is easier than ever. And so I think it's a combination of people's desire to go see the world and get out there and enjoy it, But also it's these businesses that are doing a really great job educating the public on, you know, the experiences that they have. And so I think that's a continued, it'll be a continued trend. We'll continue to see that happen.
Just a couple days ago, you marked the 2-year anniversary of your IPO. I actually interviewed you on that day you went public. Tell us about your growth in the last 2 years.
Yeah, it's quite an amazing way to look back on 2 years and have crossed that milestone. You know, it was a unique time when we rang that bell. We were, you know, one of the first groups that could get on stage with more than one or two individuals, and we still had to have masks on to ring the bell. They were really cool branded NASDAQ Flywire masks. You know, it was the first time any of us had seen each other from the pandemic. So, you know, going to that 2-year anniversary, there's a lot of emotion in it. We've accomplished so much as a company. 8 really strong quarters of exceeding expectations are kind of now behind us. You've educated a public market investor base about our business, about our business model, and given them a chance to see us continue to execute. We've made 2 acquisitions since that period of time as well, and we've more than doubled the size of our company. And so when you look back, we've accomplished so much, but we still feel like it's just really the start of what we have to do, right? You have this amazing team. They continue to deliver results. They focus on our customers, helping them digitize with the software and payment combination. And there's just so much more work to do to bring more clients onto the platform. So we couldn't be more excited about the future, but we do, you know, we pause briefly to kind of reflect on that 2-year milestone, which is just so special. It was awesome to launch Flywire into the public markets, and it's just been a great learning experience for everybody.
How many clients do you have globally now?
Just about 3,500.
Mm-hmm. And you like to call your workforce Flymates. How many Flymates do you have?
Yeah, we're over about 1,100 now. And again, 40 nationalities, 30 languages spoken inside the company. So, you know, it's a really global team. And I think that's just a massive strength, right? It's a major differentiator. So many companies hope to go international someday. Inherently, Flywire is international just based on our Flymates and our business.
Again, that is Mike Massaro, CEO of Boston-based fintech Flywire. That's a global payments platform that was founded in 2009 and trades on the NASDAQ under the symbol FLYW.
Janet, tell us what the company does in higher education.
So you heard him mention it a little bit. As we all know, if you're a parent, tuition keeps going up and up and up. And we have pointed out many times, many colleges around here pushing $90,000 a year. That's a big amount to pay in one lump. So Flywire allows institutions to work with parents to break up the payments. They can even pay year-round when school is not in session. So they really deal with the complex big payments. That's why it's travel. That's why it's healthcare. Like if you have a big hospital bill and some of these institutions and more of them. And on the overall picture, these fintechs are why we don't sit down and mail in checks anymore. They just make it easy for things to move seamlessly and fast and securely.
This is AI, right? A bit of AI? No?
Not this. Okay. No. It's just a full-on tech and being able to move things securely through technology. A lot of it having to do with other kinds of security.
Well, Janet, we want to point this out. This market cap is about $3.4 billion at this point. The stock on the year is up 25.28%. On the day, it's up over 2%, and the shares are trading at $30.65. So things are going in the right direction for these guys.
I want to point out one other thing. As you noted, I was the first to interview Mike Massaro on the day Flywire went public. It was so unusual because not only was it during the pandemic, so people had not been at the NASDAQ in person. And of course, the NASDAQ is a more tech exchange, but to have them back in person, as many people as they could, I recall maybe 40 people, to be there in public was very big. But there was something else going on. At the time, and it continues now, many of our startups had either canceled their IPOs or had done a non-traditional one, like a SPAC, not just because of COVID, but because of market conditions. So Flywire is one of the few companies in the last 2 years that went ahead with a traditional IPO and have sort of, well, for lack of a better word, flown. to fly because of it.
Our next guest, it's a prelude to this conference Monday we've been talking about. It's a biotech conference. It is huge. Ann Moster will be a participant in one of the panels. She's been doing stories on this. It's a gathering of people from all over coming here to talk biotech. And one of those people joins us right now. Andrew Casey is president of Biotech Canada. We are told this is Canada's equivalent of Mass Bio, but it's the national group. And Andrew, am I right about that? So far, so good?
Yeah, close. We are the national organization. You're entirely correct. So we're more like the bio organization, which is the National Biotech Association in the U.S., and they're the ones that are hosting this conference in Boston next week.
Well, listen, so much to get to, but let's start with this. What is your mission? I know you're here to meet people. You're here to talk up Canada's industry. What do you walk away with? What's success in your book when you're done?
Well, when you look at this conference, it's really different from a number of other conventions. Most other conventions, you would go to them and companies would have their wares out on tables selling them. I'm being very simplistic here, but, you know, the latest widget or gadget or whatever it is that they're selling or service. This conference and convention is really more about countries, states, regions putting themselves out there for sale, saying, we want your ideas, we want your people, we want your investment. So it's a hyper-competitive space in normal times, but coming out of COVID, where every country, every region, every state recognizes the importance of having a domestic biotech industry of its own, this is a really competitive space. And so we're now in a place where the world is competing for ideas and for innovation and the technologies coming out of the industry. So this conference coming up next week comes at a critical time for the industry. And Canada, like every other nation, every other region, is competing for talent, for investors, and for ideas. And so what we're hoping to have come out of this is to really put our best foot forward, show Canada as a great destination for investment, for the talent that is needed to drive these innovations forward, and for the companies themselves, and then showcase some of the Canadian innovations that are coming out of our country.
All right. Well, he's Andrew Casey. He's the president of Biotech Canada. All right. You've got the floor. Sell us. Okay. Tell us why these companies, or why anybody listening, why should we do business, our biotech in Canada?
Well, you don't necessarily have to do it in Canada, but I would argue that we've got some of the best science in the world, and certainly it's been recognized. We clearly have a talent base that we can build on. The proximity to the U.S. marketplace is not an uncompetitive asset either. So we're next to our biggest trading partner. We're able to sort of share talent, share ideas, share investments. We can cross the border quite easily as I go down there next week and come back without any real issues. And so it's quite easy to do business. We've naturally done business in many other sectors, and biotech is no different. And I think when the U.S. is looking at what it's trying to do is protect against COVID-40 or COVID-50, you pick your year, you pick your healthcare challenge, but something else is coming. We have to get ready for it. Everybody's trying to find that next big idea. It's not all going to come out of the U.S., as we saw in the most recent experience. So they're going to be looking across the world for all sorts of ideas and talent and investments. And Canada is a good place to do that, just as good as any other place.
So, Andrew, give us an update, if you would, on Moderna. They're building a manufacturing facility in Quebec. Where are we with this?
That's right. They are building one of their facilities. I don't have all the exact details, but I think what Moderna, before the pandemic happened, of course, Moderna was like any other upstart biotech company, appeared to be a very good idea, but had yet to be proven, and then sort of took that technology, the mRNA vaccine technology, and now it's recognized as a technology that's probably going to be valuable for the world for the next 10 to 20 years at a minimum, and not only for coronavirus type of incidents. It's going to be useful for other types of health challenges. So I think they're recognizing that they've got an opportunity here, and they need to grow outside of the U.S. as well. And that's one of the areas they're looking at and setting up shop in Montreal. And sort of a good example of a company that recognizes that there is an ability to build in Canada and tap into the talent base there, and also the proximity to the U.S. marketplace.
Yeah, but I'm looking at some info here. 100 million vaccine doses a year. How was Canada able to wrangle this from us? This would have much rather been done by, you know, obviously people here would think here right in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts.
Well, sure. You know, we will always say that we're better than everybody else in the world, but I understand your point as well. You'd have to ask Moderna what went into the decision, but I would say, based on what I could tell, and certainly it's the case with other companies that are global in nature, Canada is one of their places that they're going to do their manufacturing, not the only place. So there still is manufacturing capacity in the U.S. I think, like every company that went through the pandemic and recognized that you could have issues from a supply chain, And from a distribution chain aspect, in the middle of a pandemic-like incident, you need to make sure that you've got that chain as broad and secure as possible. So if you rely on just one place to manufacture and distribute, and something goes wrong in that part of the world, then you've got a problem in your entire chain. So I think that this is just a recognition that you need to be a bit more diverse than just having it in one place.
Talking with Andrew Casey, he's the president of Biotech Canada, and we're talking about Bio International Convention. It's June 5th through the 8th, right there at the Boston Convention and Exhibition Center. Okay, so Tom asked you, you know, what's a win for you? You know, what's success that come on June 9th? I guess I'd like to press on that a little bit more and say, okay, so what will you be doing during this conference? What are your some immediate priorities as you move through the 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th?
Yeah, and let's look at this in the context of a win in the context of next week, right? And there's bigger wins out there which are longer term, which is really building the capacity in the country, and that takes a lot more than just one convention. But for next week, what we're doing is we run the Canadian Pavilion. So when you go around that trade show floor, and you're going to see the different districts and states and regions, other countries are going to be there. Canada will be there with the flag proudly above our pavilion space and with all of our partners, but it's Biotech Canada's actual pavilion. And so we're there. What we're doing is connecting our companies with investors. We're connecting them with talent. We're trying to attract other companies, just like every other country, putting out the welcome mat and saying, we're a place that you want to come and do business. We've got the ability to sort of grow your company. And I think just, again, putting Canada out there as a really competitive advantage, if you're going to grow, just to your Moderna example before, hey, this is a place you can do it and actually be successful in a global context.
You know, Andrew, you probably don't want to share this with us, and I don't blame you, but here goes. I mean, you probably have a short list of companies that you would want to approach here and say, hey, what about Canada? Can you talk about those companies, or at least can you talk about what these companies do and what would be a best fit for your country?
I mean, I think it's a really good question. Is there a short list? There's probably not a short list. We're open to whoever wants to come here. The realistic possibility is it's going to take a company that's at scale already to come here. I mean, you could take a smaller company that's really looking to grow, but I think the more realistic possibility is to look at like the Moderna example, where they've got a head office and a core base in the U.S., but they're looking to set up facilities outside of the country. I think those are probably the sweetest spot for us as a country right now. Mm-hmm. And then the other part would be, it's not about just attracting the companies themselves, but also the investors, right? Because the investors are like tourists. They're roaming around the world. They're looking for the best return on the investment, the most comfortable place to place that investment. We want to make sure Canada's on that list. So probably more important for a lot of our companies are the investors. And the big pharma companies come also in the form of an investor, where you see those partnerships take place. So if I were to develop a short list, I would say any global pharma company that's looking to sort of expand its operations, invest in the country, that would be the short list of company. Mm. And there are not that many, but those would be the ones that I think would be the most valuable for us over the period ahead.
Wait a second, we have breaking news.
We are number one.
We're number one. We're number one.
The big dog. Ruff, ruff.
Big dog. Ruff, ruff.
I'm Joey Tribbiani, and here are today's top stories.
All righty. Number one story. It is about contraction, and it's Goldman. Goldman flags 25% drop in trading revenue as job cuts loom. Now, here it goes. They're looking for some big job cuts, and the president, John Waldron, is telling us in this story that we're now embarking on additional targeted action with our headcount. He went on to say the bank's trading business is trending down more than 25% this quarter compared with a year ago. So you may remember, and Bloomberg's been all over the story, as you would expect. Earlier, we've been reporting these layoffs in waves, and this is certainly the next step in all of this. And so it's a story everybody's paying attention to. When Goldman moves, people pay attention. So that's the number one story on the Bloomberg terminal on this day. Joe.
All right, we're continuing to watch the debt ceiling deal down there in Washington. As we all know, that they're the President and Speaker of the House, so they struck a deal. They made it through the Rules Committee of the House, and it passed the House, and now it's on the doorstep of the Senate. So what happens next? Well, that's a good question. You know who knows the answer? Our next guest. That's Eric Watson. He's Bloomberg congressional reporter. We welcome him to the program. All right, Eric, where do we stand on this Thursday night?
Well, I'm getting three different answers. I just asked Susan Collins. She says they're going to vote tomorrow. Joe Manchin says they're going to vote tonight. Kirsten Sinema says they're going to vote tonight. It's going to be one of the two. Basically, they're trying to work out a deal on these amendments. Could be anywhere from 8 to 15. We're told probably 10. You know, these are all going to fail, but each individual senator wants to get a vote on their thing. And once they get that, they'll drop, you know, what's called a hold or you know, sort of a blockade of this moving forward, and everything will come together pretty quickly. I'm thinking we're going to see the final vote probably 10 p.m. tonight, but it could still slip till tomorrow.
Well, tell us a little bit more about this hold. I mean, what these people want to make sure that their idea gets a review, as it were?
Yeah, well, for example, I talked to Rand Paul. He has an idea to balance the U.S. federal budget in 5 years by cutting 25% of everything, including Medicare. He wants to see how much support there is, so he wants to put that on the floor. It probably gets 5-6 votes, maybe a bit more, but he's pushing that idea and wants to sort of publicize it. That's one example.
Yeah, but Eric, do any one of these senators really want to be the person to hold this deal up and possibly have the country slip into default? I mean, the media scrutiny, the intenseness of the television camera lights at that point would really be pretty uncomfortable.
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, at one point when he still thought he could influence the deal, Mike Lee was making a lot of noises about that. But, you know, the deal's pretty much done. The House passed it and left town. It's gone. You know, so it's just not really realistic to reopen this at this point. You know, there are some amendments that could be sort of tweaks, really. For example, there's something called administrative paygo that requires the administration to take every regulation, and if it raises spending, do a different regulation that cuts spending. But there's a waiver in there. So somebody wants to take that waiver out so that it really makes it binding. But, you know, at the end of the day, I think a lot of Democrats are going to stick together and kill that because they know amending the bill, even if some of them might like that change, will just cause chaos. So I think it is just the way the Senate operates. People want a grandstand. And in the end of the day, it's going to pass.
Wait a minute. You just said lawmakers want a grandstand? Let me wrap my mind around that a minute. Eric Wasson is with us. He's a Bloomberg reporter. Eric, yesterday we had Congressman Seth Moulton on this program. He represents our 6th district in the Commonwealth. And, you know, Congressman is a bit of a troublemaker, and we always like that here on the program. But here's what he said, and I want you to react on the other side.
If it goes to the Senate and gets amended in the Senate, and then they have to send it back to us in the House in a different form, then it's open season. We don't know. I mean, there might be more people who object to the amended bill.
Yeah, you're opening Pandora's box and everything's going to fly out. I mean, things just unravels. I mean, so that's the same thing. There was no amendments in the House. Like, once the deal is done, I think basically the way Congress operates is even though technically, you know, and there's a lot of people pushing for this open amendment process, and maybe we'll see that on the annual spending bills, these big last-minute deals, it just would be untenable, quite frankly, to actually have a bunch of...
And they know that, right? In other words, they know if they start messing around with it, it might backfire.
Oh, sure. And some of them do want it to backfire. There are some on the right who don't believe Janet Yellen's deadline. But I just don't think that's really where we're headed at this point, quite frankly.
Well, Eric, tell us what drop-dead deadline it seems to be the common agreement here. Where is everybody on when this really has to get done by?
I think they want to get it done before June 5th. You know, at least the leadership does. But the Senate has enough procedures that it started the process today, could drag it to next Thursday. So we're well past that. But I'm not hearing anybody who's going to actually bring that. We have seen people filibuster into a government shutdown. Rand Paul himself did that at one point, where it caused a 6-hour government shutdown. But I think there's a feeling that that's something that people are more willing to play with. Maybe delay someone's paycheck or whoever's on the night Saturday shift that a certain agency didn't show up. But, you know, I think in this case there's not a real willingness to say it's more bluster about the default.
Eric, take us forward now. So this gets done. We will assume, for our purposes, and take us through the summer here. I mean, there was talk of this looming October shutdown, a potential for that. Does this prevent a shutdown in the fall?
It doesn't really, actually. There is a mechanism in here that would cause an automatic spending bill to be enacted at a 1% cut in January if they haven't done their work. And that's more to incentivize them to finish all of those annual appropriations bills in detail, how to spend. But there isn't something that's automatically going to happen in September 30th. And I'm thinking this is my theory, is that Kevin McCarthy's on really thin ice with his right wing. He's going to meet with them next week. They could try to start agitating to bring this motion to oust him. And he's got to make a series of promises. So we're going to be tracking that. What's he going to promise? I think it's going to be more cultural red meat, really. It's going to be maybe even impeaching Alejandro Mayorkas at the DHS. You know, we've seen him already release more January 6th raw footage to right-wing media, which has been a demand of January 6th doubters. You know, we could see promises like that, and maybe even that he'll try a shutdown over the border wall or something like that. Wow. So I think it's still a risk, you know. But again, a shutdown is orders and orders of magnitude.
Hey, can I ask you a quick question? Who is the ringleader of this group you're talking about? It's the Freedom Caucus, right?
Yeah, there's not, you know, because they're kind of an independent mind. I mean, Scott Perry of Pennsylvania is the chairman. But, you know, there's a bunch of different people like Andy Biggs, the former chairman, who is really a critic, or one might even say enemy, of Kevin McCarthy. People who just never voted for McCarthy, never voted for any of his debt proposals. And they're out there agitating. But Dan Bishop was the one who told me and others that he's going to bring this motion to vacate this device to try to force an immediate vote on whether the speaker should still be in that chair. But my colleague Billy House had a great scoop a couple of weeks ago, where those same Democrats who stood up and basically voted this debt deal through, voted the procedures through, they've also gone to McCarthy and say, if this ever happens, there's just a handful of right-wing people, we will we'll bail you out. Now, he said he didn't welcome that, and of course, politically, he'd be weakened because he'd basically have been, his bacon would have been saved by the minority. It will be in an uncharted territory. But we could actually see that as soon as next week if these guys bring this vote.
You're saying the Democrats would step in to save McCarthy?
Yes, because traditionally, as we saw in the speaker race, they would, you know, they would vote against, you know, they would vote to out, you know. But they would actually vote to keep McCarthy there.
Because we asked that question to Seth Moulton, and he obviously said, "Well, I'm not gonna do that type of thing."
Right. But there's people like Dean Phillips, who's one of the problem solvers, who had said that he would do that.
Yeah.
Well, but Moulton threw him a vote on getting this thing moving, right?
Right. On the rules portion, right. Which I guess he voted in favor.
Yeah,
of.
It's going to be a numbers game. I think that this probably, you know, McCarthy can only lose 5 if it's a strict party line vote. I think there's between 5 and 10 people would probably vote to oust him. But if it got way up into the 30 or so 40s, maybe there's not enough Democrat votes to save him anyhow. And at that point, he's so weakened that. But the real problem is there's, for the opponents of McCarthy, there's no great alternative. I mean, Steve Scalise is capable leader, but he signed on to this debt ceiling deal that they hate so much. So it's like, how far do you go down the line of leaders that are acceptable both to the Freedom Caucus? Again, you have to remember the ones who are in the swing districts, who won this majority for them, people in Biden district, they got to sign on too, you know, and you got to find some consensus candidate. And they're not going to elect a Freedom Caucus speaker because they will lose their job in the next election for that. These are not, you know, they're elected by independent voters, not by sort of a gerrymandered set of very far right Republican primary voters.
But Eric, well, last question for me. If you're correct in what you're hearing from some of your sources there, that there could be a vote tonight at like 10 o'clock in the Senate, and if it passes, we're done. It's on the president's desk tomorrow, or something else need to happen?
No, we'll be all done, and then we can pack away all of our talk about minting the coin and premium bonds and the 14th Amendment, and then bring them out in 2025.
All right.
I'd like one of those coins.
Yeah, let's have one anyway.
Yeah. All right. Symbolic. Thank you, Eric Wasson, Bloomberg Congressional Reporter. Tom, what do you have for us tomorrow? You got anything going
maybe
on?
Maybe you should just show up for work tomorrow.
All right. Well, maybe I will. Okay.
Now, listen, Janet's got a story. This is crazy. They're going to do cliff diving down at the ICA site down there in the waterfront. This means that they erect these. She's shown me pictures today of these giant diving platforms that they're going to go off of. We're also going to talk to Jerry Denterline. She runs Denterline. She received a big leadership award from the Greater Boston Chamber of Commerce. And so we'll talk to her about that as well. And a report from the Beer Institute. Are you thirsty? Come on. Bloomberg Daybreak Asia starts right now.